Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to The Female Gaze, a podcast that celebrates and dissects the female gaze in art and popular culture. I'm Jessie Katz, joined today by my brilliant co-host, Alana Rodriguez.
Hi, guys.
And our very, very special guest, Skyping in all the way from literally the streets of London, where she currently lives, filmmaker and female gaze icon, I would say, Desiree Akhavan. Hi, Desiree.
Hey, I'm so sorry I'm on the street right now.
Can you set the scene for us? What do you see in front of you
right
now?
Paint the pic for us.
So many shoppers. I am in shortage.
Oh, man.
Which is like the Williamsburg of London.
Okay.
And I am walking back home.
Okay.
From a meeting I couldn't reschedule.
Got it.
And this is my life, is like taking important calls while on the street and like almost getting hit by a car. This is my reality.
We are so honored and happy that you are able to dial us in from the street. So thank you.
Yeah. And don't die for our
you.
Sake.
Yeah, please.
If you have to throw the phone and run, we'll understand.
I was just in London and I was actually shocked by those big red buses. They don't give a fuck what you're doing. If you're on one of those little bikes,
no.
They will trample you.
They don't at all.
There's no pedestrian.
If you sit at the top, sorry to cut you off, but if you sit at the top and you look out, it's like you just get so fucking close to the other cars.
Yes.
It's really terrifying how tight those spaces are.
It's horrible.
Okay. Well, stay safe out there.
Stay safe.
Okay. So, guys, if you aren't familiar with all of Desiree's projects, get cracking. Desiree is the writer, director, star of a film very beloved by me and many people I know, the 2014 film Appropriate Behavior. She's also the writer, director of 2018's The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. No small thing. And Desiree is a creator and star of the new series, The Bisexual, which is now available on Hulu. But before we get to all of those amazing things that Desiree has made, it's time for a round of float your boat and be in your bunch. Okay.
Oh, man.
So we are going to start us off and then we're going to toss it to Desiree. But Desiree, feel free to chime in if you have any thoughts on our picks of the week. All right, Alana,
yes.
Will you start with float your boat? What's floating your boat this week?
What's floating my boat? Okay, so it is a couple things, but it's all related. There is a woman. Her name is Joanna Toruño. She is from El Salvador. She has an account. It's called the Unapologetically Brown series. And essentially, she is creating art to uplift people of color and queer people of color in the community. So she was born and raised in El Salvador. At 10 years old, she moved to New York. She was very inspired by a lot of really important writers and culture and politics. And I think for her, she was like, why is there no place for me to see people like me or express myself? So she started creating art, and essentially it's like her own poetry or her own words. And I'm going to find one that's pretty interesting. And she layers it with really beautiful art. So she will say, I'm trying to find it right now because it's in my Instagram. For example, she has, and sorry guys, you can't see this, but I really encourage you to follow the Unapologetically Brown series on Instagram. But it's a beaut, like this is a poster, and it is beautiful, earthy flowers. And on top of it, she writes, heteronormativity is a mediocre colonial concept. And she'll just stick it around New York City. And then there's another one that says, brown girl, heiress of the streets, walk tall with your head high, melanin dripping from your thighs, vibrate the city with the strength of your ancestors on your hips. Brown girl, this world is yours. So she like creates this beautiful art with empowering messaging, and she just puts that shit up all over New York City. So it's really what's floating my boat, just that particular account, this incredible woman. And we will tweet out this article that talks a little more about her. It's on Nylon, written by Angelica Acevedo. So we'll tweet that out. But I love it. I think it's awesome. Super empowering. Fucking awesome. That's floating my boat.
Have you seen it? in New York?
I haven't seen it, and I am on a I'm trolling the streets to find it. I'm trolling.
It's a good scavenger hunt for anyone in New York.
It is. It is. And with the day that I find it myself firsthand, I will take a photo with it.
Beautiful. Good. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Okay. My float the boat this week is the movie Let the Sunshine In, which is a very bad English translation of a French title, which is more like Interior Sun. But it is directed by Claire Denis, starring Juliette Binoche. And it's actually available on Hulu right now, not to keep touting Hulu, but I guess it's appropriate for this episode.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I saw it on some critics' best of lists for performances this year, and Juliette Binoche is always amazing. She's especially amazing in this. It's basically a movie about a woman who goes from one bad relationship to another. So on its
surface,
sounds
like my life.
Yeah, and it honestly doesn't sound like a very appealing story to me, because I feel like how many kind of sad sack middle-aged women having bad romances do we need in the world? Like, it doesn't sound like a very empowering film, but the way that it's shot and written, and also the DP is a woman, Agnès Godard, is amazing, because you're just like living with this woman. The camera stays on her through almost everything, and through all of the heartache and the frustration and the resilience from one like shitty man to another, you're just in her skin. And that alone was amazing to see. Anyway, so I highly recommend. And that is my Float Your Boat. All right, Desiree, do you have one for us?
Yeah, so it's not at all current.
Fine.
But it is current in my life.
Perfect.
Because I've been living out of a bag for the past few months.
Okay.
And I just got back to London after doing press in various cities. And I'm in my flat for the first time, and in my kitchen for the first time in a long time. So I've been cooking, which has been really nice. And I'm trying to I'm Iranian, or my whole family is. And so I've been using the cookbook that I grew up with, which is called Food of Life. And it's by, it's actually kind of interesting. It's by this woman named Najmieh Badwangali. And she and her husband self-published the book. And they've got two kids that they raised in the States, I believe, Washington.
Okay.
And one of them is Zal Batmangali, the filmmaker, and the other one is Rostam Batmangali, the musician.
Yeah.
So they have these two kick-ass creative boys who are both queer and really talented. So it's just this family of talent. But the book that she wrote is kind of our, it was my cooking Bible growing up. And this week I made Persian meatballs. So I was really excited about that. Koufte Berinji. Cool. It came out really nicely. I followed the recipe. And I highly recommend that people get into Persian cooking. It's really good.
I feel like if you grow up eating this food, then you're going to become a really cool queer artist, is what we're saying here, right?
I think that's what we're saying.
Theme.
Go out, buy the cookbook.
Yeah.
It's really strange, because I never knew anybody remotely queer, like anyone who wasn't following like a Kardashian aesthetic to being Iranian lifestyle, monetary, fashion, etc.
Yeah.
And then now that I'm getting older, I'm meeting other people who are like, oh no, I know a bunch of gay Iranians. It's really surprising.
Like, oh, okay.
It's like, where were they all my life?
Yeah, right. Well, that's a good lesson. If you feel alone, just try to stay on this planet long enough. You'll eventually find other people like you.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, that's good.
I like that. That was a good one.
Okay, be in your bonnet. Alana.
Okay, guys. This one I'm feeling so conflicted on, and I need you to help me, because the bee in my bonnet this week is women calling women cunts. And I was feeling, I'm feeling a little bit conflicted, because honestly, I call women cunts all the time. I say that.
In what context?
Like, oh, she's being such a cunt. Or, oh, that was so cunty. You know, so
It really rolls off the tongue.
It does.
It is like
so
really
it's so
nice
flavorful.
Crunch to it.
It does. But the reason why I'm so salty is because last night my ex called me that directly at me with like, it was like a hard jab. Like it made me, she said.
It wasn't with love.
No, absolutely not. She was really upset with me. Long story short, because I was going to stop by the apartment and pick up the rest of my things, I did not give her enough notice. And in her defense, I didn't, but I thought she was going to be at work, and she was. Whatever. Long story short,
this is not really why she
called
you.
This is not why she called me.
You were being a cunt.
I was being a cunt, but she says, direct quote, she goes, "Jesus Christ, you shave your head and you turn into a fucking cunt, huh?" And when she said that, I was like, that made me feel tight.
Because right after you guys broke up, you shaved your head.
Because right after we broke up, yeah, I shaved my head because I had my Britney moment.
And became a cunt.
And I became a cunt, apparently.
Words.
Well, yeah. And it's like, also for me, I was like, well, that's a new one. That's new. Usually it's like, you're a monster. Wish I never met you. Like all of these like really dreadful things. And last night, not only was it a new word to add to her vocabulary against me, it was just very, it was full of so much
hate. I think
you're
just using this as an opportunity to rank your ex-articles.
I am done.
I think you love the word cunt. You're just mad at your ex-articles.
Maybe I'm just tight because it was directed at me.
So yeah, you already said you like to use it against other women.
It's a very. I'm taking the B personally because I was called a cunt last night.
Okay,
so,
it was a very specific B. How did
Desiree? You like
bonnet?
Tell me you like the word cunt.
I really like cunt, but I can understand if someone was like, "That's if it." It's so personal. Like I like the word dyke a lot, but I wouldn't use it as a slur. I think that's probably it. Like, with what intention are you using the word cunt? But you know what? Like in the show, in my show, which I'll plug right now,
The
Bisexual on Hulu, I do say someone's such a fucking cunt, and I say it with anger. Yeah. It's not something I use that much in life, but I think it's unfortunate because it's a beautiful word.
Yeah.
And maybe I need to reevaluate my intention with it.
That's exactly what I was thinking too, because it means, you know, it's like, you know, a woman's vagina. Like why should we be using that as a negative thing to call another woman when it's what makes us a woman and it
empowers
us.
But you call people a dick. Like insults are insults. Like you say them because they're like, it's language. It's about the intention of it matching the sound of it, I think.
I think you're right. I had the same thought about dick, too. I was like, we call people dicks.
I think also part of our hesitation about it is that historically these are words that have been used by the people who don't identify that way as an insult, right? So, like, I don't think any of us would really love for men to call women cunts. Only we get to say
it, there's something very violent about it. Like, I guess there's a violence there. The same with faggot that really upsets me.
Right. Yeah, me too.
Okay.
Okay, well.
We found our middle ground there.
Thank you, guys.
We're
Thanks
all just kind of meh without an answer on that one, huh?
Okay, well, how about that? I would like you guys to help me on my B. I get really annoyed when white friends text non-white emojis. And I don't know if I'm being overly sensitive about this, but it drives me fucking nuts. So I have one.
I find it really annoying,
it's
too.
It's so rude. I'm like, you're not brown.
I just feel like we all made
a little too progressive. Right. A little, like, adorably progressive.
But no one gave them permission to do that yet.
It gets under my skin.
We all made a silent agreement to use the emojis that we feel closest match our skin color, right?
Absolutely.
Like, until there's a purple middle finger.
It's always the whitest people I know who do it.
Yes.
That's right. The thing. If it were like my coolest friends,
I'm like, why are you
it's
using
not,
that?
Yeah.
You do not have that much melatonin. That is not correct.
Right. Okay, good. So we all have this tea. Okay.
Agreed. Okay. I always use the honey brown. You know, that's my thing. And you know what? I appreciate.
Yeah, I use the honey brown.
Yes. Oh, me too, girl. And I appreciate when people use emojis that match their skin tone. Like, bottom line, that's why they're created. Otherwise, they'd all be the weird yellow ones that it started off with. Remember, it was like that very, like, chalky yellow?
Yeah. And I keep telling my very, very Ashkenazi Jewish friend who uses a brown emoji that just because
emoji?
She does self-tanning doesn't mean she can use that. And she gets so angry at me. But you know what? That's what's up.
That's what's up. I like that.
All right, Desiree, give us a B.
This is so, I can't believe I'm sharing this. It's embarrassing because it makes me look petty.
I think I just went there.
It makes me seem so petty, and I am petty. I just have to be honest. I've been working too much, and I'm petty, and my whole existence is about work. But I hate these end of year lists. They give me a lot of anxiety. I feel like it's the same 10 projects over and over and over again. I never discover anything new through them. I really am sick of people's end of year lists.
I agree with you. And it's also funny because, like, I'll read all of the film ones in the New York Times every year, and you know, each critic will give their own list and they match like 90% of the list.
Right.
But it's like, oh, wow, you liked Star is Born right. as well. Yeah. I'm so glad we're giving that young up and comer Bradley Cooper a platform. It's just like the same things. And I'm sure if I was on every list, I would feel differently. I'd like to think that
That's
I wouldn't.
Amazing.
I'd like to think that even if I were being heavily featured, I'd think...
I love that.
I don't know. It's just the same things.
Yeah,
it's like the things that are, those
fucking annoying.
Well, it's, I just feel like it's an echo chamber. Right. I feel like all of media about indie cinema and mainstream cinema is like starting to blur because the lines are blurring and it's just an echo chamber of like, these are the 10 things that made the most money. Go see it.
Right.
You're like, I got it.
Or
their P&A budgets are fucking huge. That's why you love them.
Right.
Or if every single critic is picking the same indie film on their list, then what does that really say even?
Nothing.
Yeah.
And like, I like people tweeting about the swag for the film that they love that they got because they're a critic. Go fuck yourself.
Go fuck yourself. So good. Wait, okay, while we're on this subject, did you see A Star is Born?
It's like high school.
It
reminds me so much of high school.
It is.
Cool kids club. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, homecoming.
Oh,
queen.
Like the money kids club.
Yes.
It's not even cool. I just think like have an original opinion. This whole system feels a lot like the longer I'm doing this job, like the more I love it, and yet on the other hand, the more like the selling and the commoditizing of films feels like high school bullshit.
Word. Okay. Well, that's a good segue to get into your shit then.
Yeah, let's get into your shit.
That was a good B.
What a petty cunt I am.
You're such a petty cunt.
Yeah. Well, we're going to check your pettiness when you start appearing on those lists. We're going to call you up and see if you still hate them.
I know. I'd be like, how do you feel about them now?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm crying.
Let's get into the deep talk with Desiree Akhvan about her extensive work. And female gaze. So Desiree, you came on a podcast I was hosting for The Hollywood Reporter 4 years ago.
It was super fun.
I re-listened to a little bit of it until I hated myself too much to keep listening because I hadn't done it for very long. But it was the first podcast you ever did, so that was exciting. Yeah, you said. I don't know. Maybe you were being kind.
Yeah. No, I'm sure it was.
It was still a little early days.
There's been a lot of podcasts over the past few years.
Right.
And I've now become so nonchalant and phoned it in to such a degree that I'll be walking home on Shoreditch High Street while I do this.
That's true. We've come a long way. And you even did Fresh Air since then. But I do love when I feel like I've scooped Terry Gross on someone, which is how I felt when I heard you on there. When I met you, you had just screened Appropriate Behavior at Outfest in L.A.
Yeah.
Talked about Appropriate Behavior all the time, basically from then until now, because it came out.
Thank you.
Well, it came out.
I knew somebody was responsible for the five clicks we got in the past year.
Every 6 months, I go on and click again.
Yeah.
But I will say that I've spread the gospel to a lot of people because in that same basically year span that movie came out, we also saw Jill Soloway's Afternoon Delight, and also a couple movies by dudes, which I put in this grouping, which is Joe Swanberg's Drinking Buddies and Noah Baumbach's Frances Ha. I was obsessed with those four movies. And I think it's because all of a sudden, a bunch of indie films came out that showed these very multidimensional female characters that we had not seen before. And it was like, oh, something feels different about what's going on in film right now. Whether or not that's really continued to progress, I think you can probably still count maybe four movies a year that embody that. But yours was definitely one of those. And it was also amazing because if you look at you compared to those other directors, most of them have been around for a long time. I mean, Afternoon Delight was Jill's first feature, but she had been working in the industry and in TV for decades. And you just came out of seemingly nowhere to most of us and, you know, hit this home run with that movie. Anyway, so for anyone who hasn't seen that movie, you were playing what, maybe some kind of version of yourself at the time?
Yeah.
You were living in Brooklyn then, right?
Yeah.
You've since deserted us.
Left us. Yeah. I moved to London shortly after I did your podcast. But I would call it autofiction, which is a genre. I think that's what the French call it. And I like that word because I think it's fiction, but it's clearly based on something personal and the roots are real and honest. But of course, the minute you commit something to paper and start to shape it into a narrative convenient for 90 minutes, then suddenly it takes on its own life.
Sure. So, I mean, basically the movie is about a bisexual Iranian American woman in Brooklyn who is grappling with a breakup and also trying to figure out how to possibly come out to her family. And I remember you used to call it a gay Annie Hall, which I think is very accurate, especially for the structure. It kind of goes back and forth through the different chapters of that breakup. And I remember, I reheard you tell us on that first podcast that you did that you said that you have a very mainstream sense of humor and that you felt just as entitled as any white middle-aged dude, meaning just that you weren't trying to be an activist necessarily with your storytelling, but you were just telling what you thought was funny and true. And it just so happened that the very fact of that is a little bit activist and political because of your identity, right? Mm-hmm. But that wasn't your intention as a filmmaker necessarily.
Well, it's incredibly, I mean, that's the thing is that I definitely think I'm the world's laziest activist, but I can't take it away that it's really powerful to see, you know, a Middle Eastern woman who isn't also a catalog model star in something. It's really powerful to see queer stories. It's powerful to see anything that you don't see normally. Absolutely. Or especially a demographic that's either villainized or victimized on screen.
Yeah.
So I definitely consider it activism, but it's also what comes naturally. And I care most about telling a really good story and telling it honestly than shoving an agenda down a viewer's throat.
Yes. But, you know, I feel like you're being a little self-deprecating with that lazy adjective because, I mean, to make a film like Miseducation of Cameron Post, that I'm assuming was years of really fucking hard work. And again, I know ultimately you're just trying to tell a good story, but I think you're a very hardworking.
Yeah, no, I definitely care. Thanks. I care that it's a story you haven't heard before and that needs to be told.
Yeah.
I think it's immoral to take up space in someone's life with a 90-minute narrative, mm-hmm. unless you're telling something new. And I take that responsibility seriously, of the responsibility of being at the helm of storytelling and having other people's eyes on you.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. I think that's why sometimes I get overly annoyed by certain things that I just don't think we need to see anymore.
Oh, yeah.
When I saw the trailer for Mid-90s, which I haven't seen. Maybe it's a good film. I don't care about this story about white boys growing up in the 90s. Yeah. They have enough of that.
That's how
it's all we have.
Feel about Star is Born.
It's all.
Which, of course, I should admit, I haven't seen.
Okay.
But just having seen, I'm sorry, but in the trailer, there's a moment where he's like, why don't you sing your own songs? And she's like, well, no one thinks I'm beautiful enough. And then he says,
I do.
I think you're beautiful. And there's so many layers to unpack with the bullshittery that is that scene where it's like, wait a minute. You don't sing your own. That makes no sense.
Right.
You'll still sing covers. You're just ugly enough to sing some covers. And then he's like, oh, go, judging by that logic, which is flawless, actually, I do think you're fuckable enough to do some original material. Because music's all about how you look.
Thank
you so much.
We have been having this Star is Born debate for the past 3 episodes.
Every episode
because
I need to watch it so I can stand by this opinion.
Please,
it's just how I feel.
You can definitely stand by that opinion, but agree, it's just all the same shit in our faces all the fucking time, and I think that's why you are so refreshing, and there's the demographic of individuals that need to be represented is so fucking huge that it still shocks me that it's still the same movies that are blockbusters, you know, whether that's a funding thing or not, because when there is something so powerful like the work that you do, it speaks volumes.
Thanks. Then look at it this way. Sorry to cut you off, Star is Born is doing good business. That's the reason it's on the forefront of my mind right now, because I'm coming from LA where I took a lot of meetings with a lot of studios, mm-hmm. and we were talking about Star Is Born because it was just like, well, what do audiences go to? And, mm-hmm. you know, Cameron Post didn't sell out of Sundance. It took 2 months to sell. It released in like 2 theaters. It did really well, but for 2 theaters. Mm-hmm, and it didn't prove its place in the marketplace, which I'm at the forefront of my mind. I'm thinking about the business of making movies and of entertaining people and giving them what they want while staying true to my own agenda and morals. Mm-hmm. And it's really, I mean, people are trying to figure out why is this film suddenly beloved? And I think a lot of studios are thinking, you know, people just want comfort food right now, that the world is such a hard, sad place, that something very familiar, even like Crazy Rich Asians, like you're willing to, like, it's very cool that it's an all Asian cast. It is groundbreaking and awesome. But the story it's selling is a very classic narrative that we've seen 1,000 times before. And it's mm-hmm. so exciting that it has that twist. Yeah. But I definitely am aware of the fact that Cameron Post may have, you know, it definitely...
Box itself in.
I don't know. It just wasn't the right film at the right time with the right distribution plan.
Yeah. Well, I really hope, I mean, whatever you want to make next, I'm there for it. But the thought
Thanks.
That you are going to tailor your creative choices around what could do well in the box office, I mean, at a certain point, it's only going to be Marvel movies. I mean, Crazy Rich Asians and Star Is Born, those are exceptions, you know? And, yeah. You know, I don't want you making Crazy Rich Asians and A Star Is Born. Like, I'm going to keep making your shit. I think at some point, filmmakers are going to have to accept that, like, streaming platforms are going to be where their bread and butter is, because the movie theaters are
which
not
is cool,
going to be showing
which is
those.
Fine. Which is fine. You just don't want to preach to the choir. Like, I want to make a film. Yeah. I didn't grow up on art house cinema.
Right.
Like, I grew up going to go see what was playing in the mainstream movie theaters with my parents. Yeah. I went to whatever my parents dragged me to. Mm-hmm. And that would have been Star Is Born. And that's what has an impact on people's lives. And, yeah. you know, I think most filmmakers want to make work that touches people.
Sure. I'm with you. Like, why should you have to settle for streaming? Like, go fucking go for the big
box. I'm not saying streaming is bad. Like, if I could go back, I think Cameron Post would have done better on Netflix than in the movie theaters. Uh-huh. I don't think we need to be married to the way that we consume things. Yeah. But I guess to me, the idea is, like, can you tell a story? I thought that, you know, having Chloe Moretz uh-huh. in the leading role would be enough of an enticement mm-hmm. for mainstream audiences.
Right.
And now I'm like, was it?
Yeah.
Maybe there are other elements that you need to like when, you know, Jerry Seinfeld's wife puts, you know, broccoli into the brownie mix.
Yeah, that's
what else can I do?
Yeah. Right. I mean, well, we could fall down the rabbit hole on why we think Cameron Post didn't find the audience it should have.
I've become a real downer in this call.
Okay,
like
okay.
We went from like why I thought I'd become less bitter and angry as we spoke. I brought it with the top 10 list. I'm so sorry to you and your listeners.
No.
I'm just going to say that, you know, some years that the marketplace is just different. Like certain films, I don't know if Juno and... Not to say that those are the best films ever, but they were huge hits of the early aughts, were like Juno and Little Miss Sunshine. And I think in like the current marketplace, it wouldn't have done well.
No, not at all.
I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay. Let's talk about the bisexual while we still have you, because I know we don't have you all day, sadly. And I want to talk about some very specific choices that you made in that, because first of all, the show's brilliant. And I watched the first episode when I was staying with a straight married couple in D.C., some good friends of mine, and they had just put their kids to bed. And I was like, guys, this new show just
bisexual
came out on
anyone?
Hulu. Yeah, I really want to watch it. Can we watch it? And they're like, yeah. And they fucking loved it. They thought it was so funny.
Great.
Continued to watch it after I left. So I think it has a broader audience than some people might expect from the title. So basically you play Layla, an Iranian American woman living in London, and the the start of the show finds your character ending a 10-year relationship with a woman who is also her business partner. And then it follows the aftermath of your breakup as you decide to explore dating men for the first time in your life, and also kind of figure out your future with Sadie. So, okay. Let's start a little more broadly, and then I just want to zoom in on a couple of moments in particular. So, first, I have a question about how you chose to kind of split the narrative, maybe not 50-50, but a significant part of the show, there's your storyline and then there's a storyline of your straight male roommate, Gabe. And I thought that was a really interesting choice, especially towards the beginning of the series. I was wondering why you did that for a show called The Bisexual, why you would give so much screen time to this straight cis dude. And then by the time you get to kind of where his story arc ends up, you understand that like his story kind of ties into a lot of themes that the show is about on a higher level. But just what was your decision there to kind of split the narrative in that way?
Well, the thesis statement of the show when it was first conceived of, which was years ago. I mean, this has been a real journey to from concept to screen. Was a buddy comedy between a straight man and a woman who identified as a lesbian but was secretly also attracted to men. Mm-hmm. And it was always about, you know, like, who, I mean, I think for me, romantic, it was a platonic romantic comedy. And in romantic comedies, it's always this idea of like, you know, can men and women really be friends? Like, will they always be, like, very, when Harry met Sally. And, like, men and women, each one doesn't understand the opposite gender. Mm-hmm. But to me, it was always really interesting that, like, the perspective that would probably be most beneficial in that argument of, like, what's the difference between men and women or would be a bisexual person who has been intimate with both men and women and knows the difference or a lot of the differences firsthand. So that was the kernel of the idea. And then it was also about being each other's wingmans. Like, what if there was a platonic, like, bromance between a man and a woman, and that they could give each other a perspective into each other's, like, romantic interests that no one else could?
Yeah. I mean, I think that does also help towards your point of not preaching to the choir, to give people who don't share that exact identity with Layla that kind of way in to this story.
Yeah, I think oftentimes, you know, if you say that you're a bisexual, and I'll bring this into like the Tinderness, right? It automatically, you're kind of ostracized. It's like, you're not a real lesbian, or you're just like, you know, you're just experimenting. And then you kind of feel forced to be like, well, shit, I have to come in hard and I have to be this like gung-ho lesbian because God forbid I have experience with both and I'm still interested in experience with both. I get fucking reamed a new one. So I agree with you, Jesse, completely that it's a new story. It's a new demo of people targeting. And it's something that I personally have never seen before, but I identify with, which was so refreshing, honestly.
Thanks.
Yeah. And also, I just meant, like, in general, if you don't identify as bisexual and you see this title, then maybe you're like, oh, this is a niche thing that's not for me. But that, like, I had a straight female friend who was watching it and loving it, and she really loved that character of Gabe because I think she almost identified with him more than with Layla because she's straight. And so, like, the questions he's asking Layla, she also has about queer women. Okay, so there are two specific scenes I want to ask you about as a writer-director. So one is in episode 5, and it is you. So I don't know. I'll say you, meaning Layla, because whatever. I'm gonna do it whether or not I try to. Okay. So well, Layla and Sadie are broken up, and you, as Layla, surprise her at her apartment, and there's a lot of tension between you. She wasn't expecting to see you. I think she doesn't know what to do with your presence. And she goes to the sink to wash her hands, ostensibly to, like, kill time, because she doesn't know what to do. And so her back is to us.
So you whip your clothes off.
No, but there's so much. Okay, I mean, And it is also
such
funny,
a pervert.
But there's something so profound about your choices in this scene as a director that your back is to the camera, her back is to you, and you take your clothes off and hug her. And so all of a sudden there's this very unexpected nudity, but it's not for the audience's pleasure. Mm-hmm. And it's not even for the other character's pleasure. It's an emotional mm-hmm. gesture. Mm-hmm. It's like, I am here to be raw with you and real with you.
Yeah.
And I just don't think we ever see choices like that. You know, I don't think that, I'm sorry, but I don't think most male writers or directors would know how to write that scene and how to block that scene.
Completely agree. Without it being sexual, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know how much, what were you thinking when you wrote that and directed that?
Directing it was really hard because we had no time. Mm. It was the last hour of the day. And that's how most of the sex scenes happened. I don't know how the logistics of shooting the show were the hardest of my career so far.
Yeah.
It was just a really rushed shoot. And so we had 1 hour left in the day. And also, I've always shot sex scenes alongside my writing and producing partner, Cecilia Frugiuele.
Right.
And she had just given birth before this shoot, and she wasn't there for most of it. Mm-hmm. And I felt really freaked out. And yeah. I, like, full disclosure, to be honest, like, I was winging it that day. And we were just rushing and racing the clock. And I followed my instincts. I think while I was in prep, myself and my producer, Katie Carpenter, and my exec, Naomi DePere, like, we sat down and talked through each of the scenes. I forget how many major sex scenes there were, but we had listed them all out, and we had our references and our shots and had kind of compiled all of it together. And the only shot I knew I wanted for this one was the overhead shot that ends the episode.
Uh-huh.
That we had a comp in Lust Caution, like an overhead shot of both their bodies entwined. And yeah. I thought, you know, I'd like that image to be the end image of the episode if possible.
Yeah. That image also really struck me. Again, because it's not meant to be erotic. It's conveying something emotional.
It's real.
Yeah.
Well, I think that the idea of, like, how do we get from point A to B to C with the sex was really tricky. And while I was editing, this was my, like, of all the sex scenes I've shot, I feel like I shot myself in the foot the most with this one. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice and interesting to talk about it in an interview, because I always feel like I got, like, we just basically had to bide our time to the last shot, which worked, but everything else was sort of piecemealing, and I felt lost with all of it. I think the smartest move was, the taking the clothes off. And to me, that was a decision on set where it was like, well, how do we get into this? And I think it's about Layla being completely vulnerable and going for it. And I wasn't concerned with where the camera was. It was important to me that the camera was not being spoon-fed the story.
Right, yeah.
That, you know, like, you're not going to have a close-up on Layla deciding this. You're not going to have a close-up. Like, especially because we just came from the past. That episode 5 is a mm-hmm. flashback. Mm-hmm. But I think at the heart of it, it was just about vulnerability and because she has to, she's the one who's put them in that position, that she's the person who's made Sadie feel humiliated and lied to, and that this was about her opening herself up to, like, complete vulnerability and kind of begging for forgiveness.
Yeah. Well, I think it came out perfectly. I mean,
those two
images have been burned in my mind. That, like, powerful. You taking your clothes off behind her and that scene of you guys on the floor. And I know that there is a little bit of sex in between it, but I honestly don't even remember that because it wasn't even the point of a scene.
But it was also about, like, how would you, I think the question we were all asking ourselves that day was, like, well, how do you reignite intimacy with someone mm-hmm. you've been with for 10 years and then have been apart from? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not going to be that and at first, I think actually our first conversations were like fast, hard, kitchen floor, gotta fuck you right now feeling. Uh-huh. And then it ended up remaining the kitchen floor, but it was actually really slow and really tender and much more like a body, you know, and cherish. You know, cherish is such a what a let's use more derogatory cherish. Terms. What a gay way to put that, but. Like that they didn't, they already had intimacy and they didn't need urgency, yeah. that they could take their time. And that's where that clothing thing came from. Like the taking off the clothes.
Yeah. Right. Awesome.
My hair, if you guys could see the hairs on my arm, like reliving it, all my hair.
You just grew hair on your arm?
No, they're standing up now because it's just, it's so fucking rude. We've all been there, whether or not it's a 10-year relationship or a 10-month relationship. Like those are moments that are so fucking real that you kind of like, you write about them in your journal and you kind of forget because you're used to that like hard kitchen floor fucking, right? You're not used to seeing yourself directly like, holy fuck, I've been in that where the emotions are so raw. Everything is, and you're not sure if it's okay, right? Even though you've had that connection and that intimacy and that relationship for such a long time, like a moment
like
that,
it
feels, it feels like the first time. And it's just, it's shit that nobody sees that we need to see. And it's so fucking powerful. And I think that obviously like, props to you for creating this moment that really speaks to a community of people that don't see that often.
Which is humans.
Thanks.
Which is humans. But queer people.
But I also
want
to say that that...
Yeah, women.
Thanks. I also want to say that this is very much a collaboration. That, like, these scenes mm-hmm. were over, like, thought and overthought 10 different times by myself, Katie Carpenter, the producer, mm-hmm. Rianne... what's Rianne's last name? I'm going to look it up right now. Naomi DePere, our exec. And I think her last name's Jones. It sucks that I don't know Rianne's last name, but our script editor, Rianne. And Cecilia, when she was able to come join us. Like, what's so cool about having made this show is that, and like most of those women are queer.
Yeah.
There you go.
That it was all of us together sharing very personal stories. And at the end of the day, everyone gave me the control or the empowerment I needed to be at the helm of it on set. But that while we were writing, while I was shot listing, while we were picking up references in films and in photographs, it was all these women who were mostly queer and talking very frankly about their bodies and sex. Mm-hmm. And that's an experience that like I get credited for or a result that I get credited for, but the experience of it was actually incredibly collaborative.
Yeah. Okay, so then I just want to jump to the next episode. First of all, this amazing opening shot of you lying just, in bed, like such a fucking
topless.
Dude. Topless, but like, you know, hairy armpits, and you are just like arms up, chilling, like post-coital, so smug. It's amazing. Another. Like,
my brother was so disgusted with me. He was like, did you really have to do that? Does he like he was like he hates armpit hair, and I just realized the other day he had just finished watching it and he was so upset with me, but in like a very brotherly understanding way. He's like, I get it, but I also don't get it. And it's so funny. It wasn't the nudity that bothered him, but the armpit
hair. Yeah.
It was the armpit hair that was, and what I realized in that moment when he was telling me that was like, because in life I don't have armpit hair. I shave.
Yeah.
But I grew it out kind of because I knew it would piss him off. Like I thought that would be so alienating and funny. And I actually, armpit hair makes me feel kind of smelly, even though I find it hot on women. Yeah. So I grew it out just to piss my brother off. Just wanted to add that to the conversation.
Well, I guess that's a good sign then. If you've pissed off your brother, you made a good choice.
I mean, Gabe is very much inspired by my brother.
Yeah.
And we're very close. So that dynamic and that love that they have for each other, that's, you know, very curmudgeonly at times, is inspired by us.
Okay, so there's actually a moment after that I really wanted to ask you about. And I know, Alana, you had something to say about this too, which was this really fucking crazy choice that you made.
Yes.
When
in the shower.
Yes.
Yeah, when Sadie gives you some hard news. And she goes to take a shower, and the camera stays on you for a whole minute, a minute of a close-up, which maybe doesn't sound that crazy to people listening, but
believe me,
I dare you to find another movie that has given an actor a minute-long close-up with literally nothing happening, but just some subtle emotional roller coaster playing across their face. And I wonder if you had to fight for that, or was that even your idea? Because I can imagine people being like, you can't expect an audience to just watch your face for a minute, but I was fucking spellbound by it. I thought it was brilliant.
Thanks. I really thought so. First off, that is entirely Naomi DePere's idea.
Okay.
She is the exec who commissioned this show, or she's the exec I first pitched it to at Sister Pictures, which is the production company that produced it. When we wrote that, so it was her idea, but it's one of those things where we throw a million ideas, and that one was like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's apeshit crazy. Let's put it in the script, but it'll definitely get cut.
Yeah.
And then we shot it. And then when we edited it in, I thought the networks are never going to go for this. Mm. And shockingly, never did anyone give me a note on it.
Not a single note. That is shocking.
Probably because there was no other out. Like, we also didn't, if they had given a note, we would have been fucked because there was no other. I had shot myself into a corner. There was no other way to shoot
cut,
that.
And then it's like, oh, that was a quick shower.
Yeah, if you look at the scene, I mean, she goes into the shower, there's no other coverage, and then she's out of the shower, and I have tears down my face. Like, it's just a different, it's so funny to me. I mean, that really, it's, as much as I bitch and moan about having had to collaborate with so many different people, it brought ideas like that. By that, I don't mean the collaboration of writing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you can't get a costume approved without five execs being like, I agree.
Right.
Great costume. Right. Like, it's such a different process to making a movie.
Uh-huh.
Just so many things need to be approved.
Right.
But as difficult as that approval process is, when it came to something like that, which was such a strong, bold choice, nobody questioned it. And it's one of my favorite elements of the show.
Yeah.
It was just fucking perfect. And I feel like I keep going back to personal only because it's just so, it blows my mind that, you know, watching scenes like that, because it is literally as if I'm reliving moments in my own life. You know what I mean? Like,
I specifically remember.
When someone calls you a cunt and then gets in the shower.
But I specifically had that same moment, you know, where I was the one sitting and I just remember thinking to myself, like, I am sitting by myself fucking just with all of my thoughts, like seeing that reflected. It's like, that's what I was doing. And I was, you know, I could hear my ex crying in the shower. And it's like, you know, if you saw that on the film, you'd want to see the girl like, you know, in the shower, right? But it wasn't that. It was the entire opposite. So I think for me, it's just like, you know, yes, obviously, maybe there was no other plan B. But also maybe people watched it and they were like, I fucking been there. And, you know, you have that like moment of like realization where you're like, this is important because this happens. You know, and again, for the 20,000th time, like, this is real shit. Real shit that you don't see
all
the
time. And I think going bold too as a director, I think at least it was bold. Like, the things, if you execute it well and if you have a very strong point of view, there are so many misses. There were so many things that we argued about, and those were because I think they weren't as bold as that.
Agreed.
And
no doubt.
I think I was very lucky, but also the stars aligned and we shot what we intended to, and everyone was sort of on board because it was, you're with it or you're not. And I think that was the same with the title of the show, where it's like super alienating to some. It doesn't quite represent what the show is, but it's also kind of a joke.
Yeah. No, it was, I can't. I just don't have any words. It's just something. It's a beautiful piece of work.
Thanks.
And it's, I have no words. Jesse, I'm dead. I'm dead.
No, well, I'm dead. Before we let you go, Desiree, we were hoping that you would also do a quick round of our hot takes wheel with us. You're not here in the studio to spin this wheel, but we have a rickety wheel that has some random topics on it that we like to have our guests spin, and then we all go around and give a really quick hot take on this topic. So if you would allow us to spin for you.
On your behalf.
Yes.
Yes, please spin on my behalf.
Okay.
I'll spin. I'll spin for you. Okay. Oh, fuck. This thing is so rickety. Okay. I got it. Wait, do this. I'm just going to go like this. And then we're going to do that. What is this? Do you make the first move? Do you make the first move?
It's not really a hot take.
Is that a hot
take? Whoever submitted that one.
Do I make the first
move? Do you make the first?
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you make the first move? Let's chat.
Generally.
I think it's tricky because, like, I'm not afraid to make the first move, but sometimes you can feel someone else is a top. I mean, and I mean that in both straight and gay dynamics.
Yeah.
And your move is to allow them to make the move.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
I feel like that's a nice excuse for someone who's afraid to make the first.
No, I know what you mean. Well, no, like, I get it.
But you allow them to. I think you make the first move by giving them the space.
Oh, I like that.
Isn't and like providing an opportunity for them to make a move. But when in doubt, like, I'll make it. And I've often struck out. Like, I think last year I asked someone, I was like, I think I was like, I'd really like you to kiss me right now. Something so lame and cheesy. And they were like, I have a girlfriend. I remember it was like, of course not. The response wasn't just like, I'm in a relationship. It was like, what's wrong with you?
No, no, no. I just said a cheesy line from a movie. So now you have to do something cheesy. Like say, I've been waiting for this my whole life. And then we make it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Bummer. Oh,
precisely. I thought I had provided this person with the opportunity to make a move.
All right. So
but yeah,
hopeless.
No, I'm no regrets.
Okay. Alana?
I am a much better anchor than I am a hooker. You know, hooker. I'm a hoe. You know, like, I can't really go fit. If someone starts it, I'll bring it home. Do you know what I mean?
Got it.
But I'm so fucking awkward in general. And anyone who's dated me knows that in the very beginning, I don't know how to speak. All of a sudden, I lose motor control. Like, I don't know what's happening, but
that's your move.
Maybe.
Is losing motor control.
I will stay as still as possible. You know, I'll just stay still and wait for you to approach. And then once we get there, I'll have the confidence at the end to be like, we're doing this. You know what I mean? So I would love to make the first move. I'm just like completely incapable and I turn into a wet noodle. So
it's something I've become better at with age.
Yeah.
Which I don't know how old you are.
I'm
27. I just want to say that. Sorry, what?
I said I'm 27.
You're 27. I think
should I have learned
it's something
by now?
The further into my 30s I get, I start to master that because I think I used to be like that.
Yeah, and I think
that you need to change.
No, I definitely I would like to, and I think part of it for me is being uncomfortable in the sense of, you know, when you go out into the queer community and you are super femmy, not a lot of people.
For sure.
You know what? I now with a shaved head, honestly, I feel a little more confident to not be rejected.
Oh yeah, what's your life like now?
I'm feeling.
You shaved your head. Is it better?
I'm feeling a little cuntier.
Yes, fair enough.
A little sassier. I honestly feel a lot more confident because I don't have, and I had a lot of hair to hide behind. But
yeah, I think a lot of lesbians get super confident and sexy when they shave their heads, and it has like the up. It's very funny how hair is like very different in the gay world versus the straight world.
Totally, totally. And I noticed that I get more attention from both. You know, usually it's like, I know the type of girl that's going to like me, right? But now I feel like I appeal to a new group of people. And I don't know. It makes me feel a little more assured.
Has it affected how men behave with you?
Yeah, that's my question.
Honestly, men are fucking freaky. It is weird. It's like almost like a fetish now, you know. And before I shaved my head, a lot of my guy friends were like, "Ooh, that's gonna be ooh, don't do that." Like, oh, gross. But now when I do,
but now they're feeling it.
Now they're feeling it, and it's like weirdly fetishy. You know what I mean? Like, you get a lot of people that are like, "Can I just like touch your head?"
Dude, the first day that we came back into the studio after you shaved your head, we walked out and this man literally blocked your way in the middle of the street. He put out both his arms.
Yeah, that was really
he was like 2 inches from her face and didn't want to let her pass.
What did he say?
He said something.
What did he want from you?
He was like, "You're going to have to say the secret password to get by me." And I was like,
That's so intense.
It was so intense. And I tried to like play it off like a joke. You know, when you immediately don't know what to do because you're, and I was like, I got no money. Like trying to, you know, and then he like wouldn't move. And I could feel Jesse like heating up behind me. And
I was like, ready
you were
to
ready
swing.
To throw bows. Yeah. But I don't know. Men are just really freaky.
Are you guys still dating?
I am a sad, sad, lonely single. No, I'm actually not lonely at all. I feel pretty good.
There you go.
But yeah, the head thing.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that technique did not work?
The technique did not repeat. Did not work. Do not try that at home.
But I'm sure that man is still hoping you'll come around.
TBD.
I was dating someone earlier this year who kept accusing me of not making a first move, like in general, and we would be hanging out. And then so one day I went to her apartment when we were going to hang out and I walked in and I tried to kiss her and she dodged me. And I still fucked up over it. I'm like,
what a sick game was that?
Oh, what the fuck?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's really funny.
What did you say? Were you like, but you wanted this?
No, did I was you? So I didn't say anything. And then at the end of the night, I was like, you know, I tried to kiss you when I walked in here, right? And she was like, yeah, it just really caught me off guard.
Wait, but did you guys not kiss when you saw, like, do you not normally kiss when you see each other? Or did you go in like, let's fucking go? Like, did you come
no,
for her?
No, we didn't usually kiss when we, I don't know. We hadn't been dating that long, but I don't know. It was a weird thing.
That is
anyway,
really weird.
I don't know.
Well,
I'd rather not make the first move. Because I'm just all confused and I just...
Now you're just tight about it.
Yeah.
Now you're just all kind of fucked up.
It's confusing out there, guys.
I know. Stay strong, guys.
Yes.
I think that there really isn't anything... Like, I think the anticipation of rejection versus the reality of rejection is so much worse.
Yeah, agreed.
And that there actually is a lot of freedom in, like, going for it and being snubbed.
Agreed.
I say as someone who's been snubbed a lot.
So maybe our thing is anyone who's hearing this episode and there's that one person that you wanted to make the first move, go fucking do it and let
Just
us
go
know.
For
how.
It.
Go for it. I'll do it too.
Because at least, yeah.
I like that.
At least you feel like a badass. Like there's nothing going to hold you back. Yeah. There's nothing you're not going to try.
Hell yeah.
Hey man, regret is the only fear you should really carry.
That's right.
So just do it. Okay. I think that... concludes.
That's it.
This episode of The Female Gaze. Desiree.
Thank you, ladies.
Congrats on the show.
Yes.
It's fucking awesome.
Thank you.
And the film, all the things that you've made. I just want to see all the next shit that you're going to do.
You're killing it. You're such an inspiration.
Thanks,
we
guys.
Fucking love you. And
when you make that
you
Star is Born sequel, it is going to be the best sequel.
If you need two protagonists,
it.
We're here.
Yeah.
Okay, great. You heard it here first.
That's right.
Here. Thank you so much for coming on this
Thank
morning
you guys.
Or this afternoon over there in London. We super appreciate it.
And apologies
you.
For all the street sound.
It added some nice ambiance.
We like that.
We dug
like
it.
That.
All right, guys, that's
right.
It for the Female Gaze Pod. See you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.